Men and women both nourish the illusion that love is capable of taking them back to the perfection of ancient paradise, but they soon encounter the flamboyant sword of the seraphim guarding the gates. That is the reason why we take such passionate interest in the love stories that form the basis of nearly all of the world's literature. Man and woman aspire to constitute together a perfect society, a world sufficient unto itself and excluding everything else. Cardinal Richelieu one day asked Madame de Caveau, the wife of his captain of the guards, whether she would prefer the world to perish or her husband. She said she would sacrifice everything for the sake of her husband. In that case, what would become of you? Interrogated the cardinal. Ah, said the lady, we would do as Adam and Eve and begin all over again. We must face the fact that in such an attitude are hidden certain dangers, particularly that of egoism, and even the egoism of a family is not much more respectable than individual egoism. There exists in man a fundamental contradiction, infinite in his desires, he is terribly limited in his means. On the plane of love, one other person suffices to satisfy our hearts. Henceforward we can only give to those we have not thus chosen an inferior kind of affection or friendship. Love is never thought of as being divided. It is a total gift of oneself to another that admits of no reservation. In this sense love is an essentially arbitrary gift and often apparently unjust. But since it is also a gift of the inexhaustible to the inexhaustible, there is no danger, if it is well understood, of its reaching satiety. It is nevertheless important to realize that, if it is an essential part of man and woman's life, it is not for all of that the whole of their life. It is not exclusive of affections of another order and normally it should encourage them. A boy and girl who marry do not thereby renounce all affection for their parents, relatives or friends. They should, on the contrary, include this love, insofar as they can, within the scope of their conjugal intimacy. I come to you with a past which is not yours, but which we will share together in the future. In me you will love mine and I will love yours in you. You and I are something altogether new, the result of a long history that is infinitely more complicated than the few years we remember of our childhood and adolescence. I love what remains in you of the little girl and I like to hear you tell me of your childhood memories. I know that our life did not begin with our first meeting, and it is good that it should be so. You pre-existed my love as I pre-existed yours. I love in you what I do not know and what would take more than a lifetime to discover. If you were only the woman of my first meeting, you would not be so mysteriously and perpetually attractive. Human love is not outside of time, but in time. It is a history that we live together and that death will interrupt. The error of certain mortal passions is to wish to get outside of time. Conjugal love accepts the limits of time and makes of them the matter of constantly renewed joy. In accepting the limits of time, they accept the world. The home of a married couple is not a home with closed doors. It is open to the past, to the surge of memories, to the origins of man. It also opens on the future and fixes its help on the paternal mansions of heaven. It is open to the future and the children that will come. In them we recognize a double resemblance, that of ourselves and that of God, which transcends our reason and before which we can only marvel as instruments of God. Our home looks especially to heaven, to eternity and to God, who was not only present on the day we exchanged our sacramental vows but who always remains between us, not to separate but to unite us the more closely. If there is only one love, then our love is made of the same stuff that unites God to the whole of mankind and to each individual soul. We know that the mystics have always used the language of conjugal love to describe the ineffable love of God in the soul. His love for us is the story of a long and difficult courtship that culminated in a spiritual marriage. Christ is the spouse of the church. He espoused the church on Calvary and conducts her affairs with a solicitude that is ever conjugal. It is through Christ and through the Church that the couple we form and the family we have founded is linked up with the community of men. From the moment He is present, nothing is absent from the prayer we recite together. Thus a man and a woman who freely choose one another are united before God. They have come together not only for the purpose of founding a family, for they are not sure that their union will be fruitful, but also because the love they have conceived for each other has need of a confirmation and of a seal. They do not trust the intermittency of their hearts. They never will be able to take exception with the witness they have chosen. He will always be there to remind them of the hard and narrow road. This presence in the heart of intimacy, this divine law which is superadded to our human mode of acting, may seem to some to be unnecessary. They may well fear that duty will impose what the heart refuses. Such is often the case, in any event, and I admit that, in spite of my great admiration for the sublime Polylect, I am somewhat embarrassed by certain traits in Pauline's character. We like to love and be loved not because it is necessary, but because we could not do otherwise even if we desired to. There is nothing less fatal and more providential than conjugal love. It is when we try to escape God that we fall into the domain of fatality. Thus when I overcame my distaste for the character of Pauline, I discovered that there is no more perfect poem of conjugal love than Polyucte. She loves Severe by choice, but it was in the political interests of her father to give her to Polyucte. She therefore loves Polyucte by duty, and it happens that, in accomplishing her duty, she opens herself to the invasion of grace. We understand in this drama what liberty is, and that only by assuming the responsibility of a liberty that was impossible outside of marriage did Pauline fulfill herself. We cannot avoid the exigencies of the divine law. Precisely because it is a religion of freedom, Christianity is also a religion of commitment. That one word suffices to determine a life is proof of a liberty that God respects by sanctioning it. Indeed, he does even more, though, for the most part, we are not aware of it. He is, from the moment of their mutual consent, more interior to the husband and wife than they are to themselves. He is the inextinguishable hearth of their reciprocal love. Of course, violence must not be done to nature. But we should be on guard against nature's weaknesses and not presume upon its strength. It is essentially changing and diverse, subject to dissatisfaction and failings. The natural successes that we can observe around us should not delude us. They are situated in the same climate of profane antiquity which made us admire heroic women of Greek drama. They were models of conjugal love and merit all of our respect. But there was lacking to them the power to get above themselves, which is the proper quality of Christian love. These words may appear somewhat harsh to young couples beginning their married life in joyous fervor. But the mortal danger of human love is to believe in its own self-sufficiency. In truth, creatures themselves are only insufficiency, and their greatest happiness is to recognize their insufficiency. We can only fulfill ourselves by going beyond ourselves. Our temporal equilibrium is not in immobility but in change, which is constantly renewing us. In the heroines of antiquity, I admire the immobile and statuary. Faithful to their husbands as to themselves, 10 years are as one day to them. They are patient and rigid and bear up under difficulties with a melancholy and steadfast heart. And what the noble Alceste is a character in Molière's La Misanthrope, sought in death was perhaps the fulfillment that life refused her. Christian marriage is not like that. Men and women, united by the bonds of a sacrament, run sing on a galley buffeted by the winds and waves. Neither fair winds nor stormy seas can surprise them. They have accepted everything beforehand. They have accepted the wrinkles that come with age and the bitter fatigue when, on certain evenings, they no longer have the strength to talk. The burden is heavy, but there are two of us to carry it. Or rather, by a reciprocal gift, we form a community where the I and you are no longer distinguishable. Your joy is my joy. Your suffering is my suffering, your grandeur my grandeur, and even your sins are also mine. To take everything this way, the best with the worst, we must first of all have given everything. It is not easy, and it supposes a rare quality of love. Conjugal love, in effect, is above all a reciprocal gift. What we have chosen on our wedding day is much less to take than to give, to give oneself entirely and without reserve. For every man, Charles Morgan writes somewhere, the essential thing is to know to what he is capable of sacrificing his life. Such is the origin of every vocation and, consequently, of the vocation of marriage. We might say that it is a vocation of self-giving in the plenitude of human love. Higher vocations undoubtedly exist. But there are none more harmonious, and perhaps in no other does the continuity of nature and of grace appear so evident. But if conjugal love is a reciprocal gift, it does not follow that it is exactly the same in husband and wife. Man is turned towards the outside world. It is in this world that he works and creates, it is from this world that he draws the means to sustain his family. He is like the branches and leaves of a tree spread out beneath the heavens, like the roots that run deep into the nourishing earth. What man gives above all is his work, his protective strength, something that, no matter how much of it he has, remains outside of him. Woman, on the contrary, is predisposed to the household. She is that silent presence in the home which the husband, who is so often not there, knows is never lacking. She is like the sap that distributes through invisible channels the life that rises from the roots to the branches and leaves. It is truly she who gives herself without any mental reservations. It is her glory to be able to do so, as it is the mortal regret of man to be destined to exteriority. Conjugal love is thus constituted by two kinds of presence at once different and complementary. This difference explains the tragic element which, even in the best of cases, remains a part of human love. It is impossible that man not suffer from his incurable activity, from this state of distraction that is so natural for him. However humble he be, he is in contact through his work with the affairs of the world, and each time he enters his home, the whole universe follows him. He mingles all day with men, and sometimes it seems that he brings all of them home with him. His wife and children form a circle of silence to listen to this eternal traveler. What he sought and what he dreamed of in the streets and great thoroughfares of the world, he finds in his home, to sit down, to listen to the humble story of the day gone by, to relax, to forget everything for a moment, and to lay aside the armor he must wear in the world. The little community about him is as closed as a heart. But even here he must think of the problems of tomorrow, and once again a frown creases his forehead. He looks at his wife and sees her as the young girl that he took intact from the arms of her parents, and wonders if it was for this, for these few brief, interrupted instants, that he pronounced his marriage vows. Did he really give himself? Is he not at every moment an habitual criminal? What, in truth, is the gift of man? But the wife does not bother herself with such questions. She knows how to wait, and her fife, when she looks back over it, was but one long advent now filled to overflowing. She awaited the husband who would one day come, even when she did not yet know him. Now that she knows him better and better each day, it costs her nothing to wait, because in truth he never ceases to be where she is. The dialogue of husband and wife cannot be interrupted, even when they are physically separated. She has given herself so totally that he must accept her even when his mind is on something else altogether. Now, wherever he goes, he always feels the weight of her sweet and strengthening presence in his heart. Even when separation lasts for years and gives no promise of ending, it is not so much in an old album that he keeps her faded image, but in his heart as something that is ever fresh and new. Women often speak, and not without reason, of masculine egoism. But it is their role to conquer it, and they will do so only by the force of love. Why deny that man does not know how to love as woman? That it is not natural for him to give himself as entirely as she does, and that, up to a point, it is impossible? This is in no way a privilege but a burden. The true nature of marriage is found forever clarified in the famous sentence of Saint Paul, "Man is the glory of God and woman is the glory of man." Ordained directly by God, man in the world is obliged to work with his hands and his intelligence to prepare creation for the second coming of Christ.